The Clean Power Hour is brought to you by CPS America, the maker of North America's number one three-phase string inverter, with over 6 gigawatts shipped in the U.S. The CPS America product lineup includes three-phase string inverters ranging from 25 to 275 kW. Their flagship inverter, the CPS250-275, is designed to work with solar plants ranging from 2 megawatts to 2 gigawatts. The 250-275 pairs well with CPS America's exceptional data communication, controls, and energy storage solutions. Go to chintpowersystems.com to find out more.
And so we very literally accidentally invented the lowest cost CSP reflector system that I've seen. We made that pivot after Climate Tech 1.0 and the kind of implosion. And so the VCs really left the building. So over a decade, we've done Department of Energy, California Energy Commission, and actually SoCal Gas Company funded R&D to get a prototype through to be a commercial product.
The Clean Power Hour is brought to you by the Clean Power Consulting Group. I'm Tim Montague, your host. Today on the Clean Power Hour, concentrated solar power, CSP, as we call it in the industry. My guest today is John King. He is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Hyperlight Energy in San Diego. Welcome to the show, John.
I'm a fan. It's a real honor to be here, Tim.
Oh, well, thank you. It's great to get to know you a little bit and looking forward to geeking out on your technology and comparing and contrasting it to other parts of the CSP and the solar thermal industry. And, you know, just for a little context for our listeners, if you've been in the energy industry for a while, you're familiar with some, you know, the various forms of CSP. There's towers, there's troughs, and there's a lot of innovation going on in this space now. So we're going to learn about some next-gen CSP technology. So stick around. So John, how did you get interested in solar energy and what are you up to?
Thanks. Well, first you say compare and contrast, and there's no comparison. So we're going to only have to be able to contrast here, Tim. Just kidding.
Bring it on.
Yeah. It's a long story. I'll try to compress. It's kind of fun and entertaining, and I hope your listeners like it. We actually started off a long time ago trying to do algae to biofuels, if you remember all of that. And so
we
approached it from a systems engineering standpoint. So I'm a mechanical engineer by training and background. And so we felt all the genetic engineering geniuses that were going to engineer all these superior microorganisms, we're going to need cost-effective systems to grow it in. And so we were developing these algal photobioreactors and just trying to address the heat and mass balance of the whole thing. And so we had these plastic tubes, and we had some thermal buildup issues, too much heat. Algae don't like it. So we initially put the spectrum splitting film on the tops of these tubes, which is stuff that actually goes on luxury vehicles to let in visible light, but keep the infrared out, keep the cabin of the car cool. And we thought we'd do the same thing. And the mixing mechanism, and I keep one around here. I'll show it. And if my description doesn't work, you can help for the listeners. You got a plastic tube here, and you got in and out for the algae culture and CO2 and all this stuff. And we were mixing it, like rotating the tubes, and the spectrum splitting film we put on top. And we realized if we use the mixing mechanism actually to rotate the tube a bit and aim the reflected IR, and we did that a little bit differently for each tube, we could actually concentrate the reflected IR. And then we thought initially we could use that high quality heat we were now getting, to do some processing, some thermochemical or thermobaric or something, processing on the algae. And then we realized, wait a second, let's just replace that spectrum solid film on top with a full spectrum reflector, also known as a mirror. And then we've just got a CSP system, concentrated solar power system. And it ends up being an LFR, linear Fresnel reflector, because it's a series of flat reflectors. And so we very literally accidentally invented the lowest cost CSP reflector system that I've yet seen. We made that pivot after Climate Tech 1.0 and the kind of implosion. And so the VCs really left the building. So over a decade, we Department of Energy, California Energy Commission, and actually SoCal Gas Company funded R&D to commercial, you know, to get a prototype that you just saw there on the video and to through to be a commercial product. And that's the background. That's how we got to where we are now.
And so you now are in commercialization. What exactly is the status and what is the market niche that you are going after?
Yes. Great question. So we have an operating system, you know, our commercial product is operating at a demo site out in Imperial County, California, a couple hours east of where we are in our headquarters here in San Diego. And we just signed a heat purchase agreement for a 6 megawatt thermal project up in Bakersfield, which is in Central California, in the Central Valley. And that's what is the niche? What are we doing? So we're doing a few unique things. We are going to actually do decarbonization of oil production with simultaneous renewable electricity production. And that's very unique. Nobody's done that before. And there's a significant overlap, and it takes a little bit of explanation. In the first place, there's a lot of oil production globally, maybe 4 or 5%, something like that. I don't know what the exact number is. In California, it's a huge percent of what's called heavy oil. Okay. And you need to actually, what they do, and this is happening now as we speak, you burn natural gas to make steam, and you have injector wells that heat up the formations to get the oil so it flows to the surface. And so that's heavy oil production. And it's more carbon intensive than conventional oil. So it's like 4% of what we do in North America, something like that. So what we are doing in the first place is using concentrated solar power with our technology platform to make that steam and displace the natural gas. So we're just very simply reducing carbon intensity of existing oil production. That's point number one. And that's what that
that's
project
is. Bakersfield project, is that
you,
style
you got
of
it.
Okay.
You got it. You got it.
How big is a 6 megawatt facility?
It's going to be about 5 acres.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
the footprint's pretty small.
So that's thermal. 6 megawatts thermal. So yes, people don't realize CSP benefits because you use not just the visible portion of the spectrum, but the infrared portion. So infrared is about half the energy in sunlight. So you actually get a significant amount of extra energy if you do CSP on the same footprint versus PV. Mm-hmm. PV obviously has the advantage that you go straight to the electrons, you get the electricity, whereas right. CSP, because you got the heat, if you don't use the heat as such, you have to convert it to electricity and you use like a steam turbine and you have that step down in efficiency that any heat engine has. So that's why if we were going to power, it would be significantly less output on a megawatt basis. But since the site and other sites like this need the heat directly, for that reason, it's pretty cool.
For our listeners, one of the advantages of CSP is that you can get broader shoulders, meaning you can store the thermal energy and then utilize it when the sun goes down, right? Which you can't do at all with traditional PV. So that is ostensibly one of the key advantages of CSP. But the economics have been challenging, and so how do you see the economics and the economic opportunity? Okay, you're decarbonizing the oil industry. We want that. Are there other major plays in the energy transition that you see your technology being relevant to?
Yes, strong yes. And you couldn't be more right on talking about that energy storage piece of it. If it's thermal, it's literally, in some cases, you're storing energy in the equivalent of rocks. And so compare the cost of rocks to batteries. Some people say literally dirt cheap to store thermal energy because you're literally using dirt. And so a lot of the above ground technology is centered around that, like big concrete blocks or similar things. And that cost of storage really is very low. Here's another thing I hope listeners will be interested in and really find entertaining and interesting and valuable. I'm literally doing business development at these oil projects. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. So you know, old John here went to Caltech and is aware that energy is neither created nor destroyed, right? And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, we're putting all this solar heat down hole, but the thing that these guys are producing is the oil. The heat isn't making the oil, right? Where's this heat going? What's happening here? What's going on? And I'm asking them, and they're like, oh, well, it just stays down in the rock until we bring it back up. And I said, what do you mean bring the produced fluids? It's not just oil coming out of the ground. It's actually 5% oil. It's 95% hot water coming up from these things. And I'm like, what? You got to kidding me. What we're doing is making gigantic synthetic geothermal reservoirs with sunlight, which is very literally storing sunlight in the rock at massive, massive, massive scale. Here's another really, this is just so fun to talk about. I hope you get a kick out of this, too, and I hope your listeners do too. So we've worked with NREL, National Renewable Energy Lab, for like over a decade. Great, you know, world-renowned renewable energy lab. So I realized this, and I think to myself, okay, we got to do, there's geothermal power plants that use this kind of quality heat, and they do power generation. And if the rock's hot, this is solar with an on-off switch, right? So I call up my collaborator there, and I say, hey, we got to do, I explained everything I just explained to you. And I said, we got to do this. We got to make power. And the guy says, John, I'm so excited to hear about your visionary idea. Thank you for telling me this. Yes, I agree. We need to do this. And did you have a chance to read the paper I wrote about this that I sent you 6 months ago that's in your email inbox? I said, oh, shoot.
That's hilarious. Sorry.
Yeah. I didn't say shoot. I said a different word. But then we had a good conversation.
So he's part of the company, or he's still a scientist over at NREL?
Guangdong Zhu is the guy, and there's a couple of people that work over there. Josh McTeague is another. They're both on this paper. There's Prashant, I haven't worked out with him as much, but they're all still NREL, and it's a great public-private partnership. They keep doing a lot of the analysis, modeling, design stuff, and I'm out there identifying places to put this stuff, and it's just been a great partnership so far.
It's an important role that government plays. As Jigar Shah pointed out on an interview that will have already published by the time this comes out, and he admits freely that he was not, you know, really paying enough attention to that, that it takes both. It takes the market and government resources to drive this energy transition effectively and at scale. And that's the challenge, is we need to decarbonize the economy. That's 40 gigatons approximately of CO2e or CO2 equivalents. And then we need to remove 800 gigatons from the atmosphere, which has moved the needle from 320 ppm to 420 ppm. When I was born, it was 320 ppm. Now it's 420. And it's going up, okay? It's still going up. And so now we're realizing that, oh yeah, now it's really getting serious and we're probably looking at 3 degrees C of warming. I don't know that I want to be here under more than 3 degrees C of warming, but I probably won't see that day. So anyway, what are your thoughts about, you know, how do you really dig into the energy transition with your technology?
Yeah, first off, it's a real honor to be on the same show that Jigar Shah was on. I'm a big fan of his too, all the way back from Sun Edison days. You know, he was a leader, basically created, the main guy creating the whole category of like solar PPAs that really blew open the blew the roof off, and it just went stratospheric. And obviously he's doing great work at the DOE LPO right now. So cheering him on, go Jigar. And then the role of government is, like you said, with the national labs, you have a ton of innovation and you have the early support and you have the policy, and it's across the board. It's both the state and federal level. Like the innovation that Jigar came up with and commercialized at Sun Edison, it also benefited from the California Solar Initiative and the federal investment tax credit, right? And so I remember watching this. In fact, I was involved on the California Solar Initiative, the CSI. I actually was one of the engineers that designed some of the back-end stuff, actually on the software, to process the $3.2 billion in rebates before I did what I'm doing now. And that creates this virtuous cycle where, yeah, okay, you're at X dollars per watt installed now, but it's subsidized, so it's profit. The companies go after that. And because they're competing for that, they are out-competing each other to get better technical performance and lower cost all at the same time, going down that cost curve, increasing the performance curve and decreasing the cost curve. And you keep doing that year on year. And what they accomplished was this astonishing, like 90% decrease in equipment cost. So now you don't need the CSI. It doesn't exist anymore. And the ITC has been reduced. And you still see PV out there going strong. And that wouldn't have happened without the policy support, both at the federal and the state level. So I strongly agree with that. In CSP, our sort of version of the CSI is the low carbon fuel standard in California, which helps you it's great for solar heat because you have this large market potential with the enhanced oil recovery. The steam to get the heavy oil out is a large volume. So it's a mechanism whereby we can follow the same virtuous cycle of chasing after the existing subsidies. And then as we deploy and go out, our costs are coming down. And because of higher volume, the price for that particular kind of carbon reduction is going to go down the more we deploy. And then we follow the same trajectory. So I'm absolutely hoping to follow that same trajectory. And by the way, so that power production piece that we're piloting at the same site in Bakersfield, my hope and my dream is that that's just the first step, and that we are able to scale that up and get to the point where we no longer need to be co-located at the oil, and we can do a greenfield. In other words, you could drill new wells. The wells don't already have to exist because we followed that cost reduction curve. And so then we have solar with an on-off switch because of the massive geological storage of the solar heat. You bring it to the surface and make power anytime, day or night. So that's the dream. And bluntly speaking, you've got the other thing. The federal ITC is there, and you've got another California. It's not even a subsidy. It's just they're saying, look, we're going to procure right now 11.5 gigawatts of renewable energy. And they've got a carve out of 1 gigawatt that has to be 80% capacity factor, 100% renewable. Mm-hmm. So just saying, mm-hmm. This is what we want. Market, figure it out. You know, we're throwing our hat in the ring and saying, look, this is going to be our push to figure out the solution to your problem here.
And what are the geographic restrictions on achieving that 80%?
Excellent question. So this is actually the perfect, the setup right now is perfect. In California, there's 100,000 of these oil wells. Look, they're not going to be producing oil forever. So we believe we could use them all to do this. We believe we could repurpose all of them. And if we did that, you're talking about literally six cubic miles of geology here. So cubic miles of rock. The storage capacity of that is over 1 billion Tesla Powerwalls worth of energy. Like that's an enormous amount of rock.
Yeah.
So that energy capacity is equivalent to all of the natural gas power plants in California combined. So California could literally get off natural gas power plants. The technical potential is there. And the beauty is then you say, okay, great. What about the rest of the country, right? Well, if you do that, you will have reduced your costs and you've learned so much and you've scaled up that you don't need the old wells. You could maybe go to Texas. There's a lot of wells there that you could start with there. But you really, to do it technically, you really only need a sedimentary formation. And a good 75% of the country is over sedimentary formations. Like most of the population centers have these sedimentary formations. So you can do that. This technically, you can do it anywhere. What I'm describing in the oil patch is really just the low-hanging fruit where we get started with it.
But is there a threshold for the solar resource? I think of CSP as being really good in the desert Southwest, but when I talk to people about Illinois, they go, "Yeah, probably not, because we're too cloudy." But what are your thoughts about that?
Yes and no. Yes and no. And it's there's a Venn diagram, right, where the solar resource is just one of the circles. The other circles on the Venn diagram have to do with the cost of the equipment and policy. And I think that if you get your cost of the equipment lower, the area on the map, like those gradients of like solar resource that you can do it, they expand. You grow the area on the map where it makes sense outside mm-hmm. the desert Southwest. And this is going to maybe make you and your listeners fall out of your chair. Germany is a huge solar power, right? They've got, and I mean mm-hmm. that, the global power. Like they had their energy yeah. transition, their feed-in tariff. They have massive amounts of solar PV installed. If you look at a map, a solar map, like the gradient map, and compare Germany, it looks like Alaska.
Yeah.
It's the same DNI as north. Alaska. Yeah. And they did it. So the point of that is, that's the other circle on that Venn diagram of policy. Like they had very aggressive policy. I don't know that we're going to have the same aggressive, the level of aggression that Germany had, but it doesn't take a lot. If you also combine that with low cost equipment, you know, you start to grow that. The other thing is the storage. If you're storing it downhole in rock, you have massive storage. And so there's value just in doing that, being able to have that on off switch where maybe the delivered power is a little bit more expensive, but the fact that you can deliver it any time, day of night, any time, winter, summer, that's, you know, worth it too.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Clean Power Hour or viewing it on YouTube. We do have a great YouTube channel. If you're not subscribed, please go to cleanpower.group and hit that YouTube icon and subscribe to our channel. Of course, you can find all of our content on your favorite audio platform as well. So please give us a rating and review. Back to the show. What about combined heat and power? Because you're fundamentally making a hot liquid. I don't know. What is the liquid that you're using as a heat transfer?
In the first place, for our receivers, we use a thermal oil to go up to, say, 390 to 400 degrees centigrade. And that's a commercially available product. But for the actual delivery of the heat to the formations of steam, we're not going to put oil back in the ground. You know, we do a heat exchange, we make steam. So after that, it's all steam. I like heat and power. It makes a lot of sense. In fact, a significant chunk in the oil patch is CHP, actually, the cogen. They actually have a large number of natural gas-fired power plants out there, and the waste heat is mm-hmm. used to make mm-hmm. the steam to go downhole mm-hmm. currently. And it is my hope and dream and my belief that we can actually convert a lot of those cogen plants to run like this, to be solar cogen. That's a kind of utility scale cogen. If you're looking at distributed or CNI cogen, I don't know that CSP is a great, not just our company, but any CSP platform, just because it's smaller scale. And you're really looking at, you need some land adjacent to the site to get the energy to drive the heat engine on the front end. So it's to be determined on that. We haven't gone aggressively at like your commercial, industrial, your mm-hmm. CNI mm-hmm. power, but at utility scale, I'm a big believer. I agree.
So what else should our listeners know? I mean, okay, I really like the concept of replacing, you know, methane in oil fields. Great.
Yep.
Want to do that. That's a good thing. Anything that keeps fossil fuels in the ground, out of the atmosphere, that's a good thing. And we can get to maybe 50% of the grid with PV and then another 40% with wind. And then, you know, it's other, right? And so it'll be a myriad of other to fill that 10%. And, you know, we do need a lot of storage. I'm curious, when you think of a, you know, say a 100 megawatt thermal plant, and you're pumping this hot steam down into the earth, and before you do that, you can use it to make electricity if needed, right? Just run a turbine. Am I right about that? You can just run a turbine off this device, right?
Yep. You can do it. Yeah. You can make the power before you put it in the ground, or you can make the power when it comes out. I think.
And when you're pulling it out though, what temperatures can you get out?
Right. So
presumably some of the heat is dissipating into the earth, right?
Great questions. So yeah, I need to bear with me. There's some extended explanation that I think is very
okay.
Yeah. So the big thing here for geological thermal energy storage, geotests, is that we actually benefit from the 6 decades of thermal enhanced oil recovery that the oil industry has already done. So the first steam floods, as they're called, steam floods is what they're called. The first steam flood was like 1961 in Central California, and they've been operating ever since. So it's not really a science project. They know very well what the thermal round-trip efficiency of doing this is. They've studied it. They've put monitoring wells. They've measured temperatures for production wells, injection wells. And you're talking about 75 to 90% thermal round-trip efficiency over the course of like 6 to 12 months, like really high efficiencies over long periods of time. And the reason is, and that's for big formations. You have to do this big. For a small pattern, like say 2 to 4 to 6 wells, like a small pattern, no. Mm-hmm. All the heat really will dissipate out the sides of that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a large grid of adjacent patterns, then you leak out the side of one, it's just input into the side of the other one. And so it's kind of a problem of, you know, the perimeter to volume ratio, and you just want the largest volume possible, and you asymptotically mm-hmm. approach zero loss. So for say a 10 by mm-hmm. 10 grid of these smaller patterns, you're talking about like a 5% loss out the sides. And they've measured and observed the loss at the top and the loss at the bottom of where you're steaming is virtually mm-hmm. zero. It's like single digit percent. And that's because the rock, you've got rock on top and rock on bottom, that's an insulator. And the stuff mm-hmm. where you're actually doing the thermal work, it's this sedimentary stuff that's like a sponge, and your heat stays mm-hmm. there. So that really sets this approach apart. You've got 6 decades of data showing that the thermal round efficiency works. And all we're doing is swapping out the fossil-fired heat for solar heat, which is kind of nirvana, right? And so, as you say, you can make the – so that's point number one. Point number two you were talking about is like making the power on the front end or on the back end. Making the power on the front end you can do, but the question there is that goes back to just the same intermittency of solar. The value of this approach, in my opinion, is the fact that it's not intermittent. It's dispatchable. You can do it anytime you want. And then you really have to mm-hmm. accept the fact that you do have lower temperatures when it comes back up. And so mm-hmm. we do have one little special sauce aspect that's – so I'm being an evangelist for the category of geotests, geological thermal energy storage. I'll pitch my own little special sauce here briefly. We have this platform called Tectonic Sun, which we cheat a little bit. We keep a little bit of the solar CSB heat, that high quality 390 to 400 centigrade heat. We keep a little bit of it. We hold it back. We keep it at the surface. We put the majority of it downhole. So then when it comes up, it's like 120 centigrade, just barely above boiling. Mm-hmm. But then we use that little bit we kept at the surface, and we can do superheating. So we go ahead and raise it back up so it's higher quality. So the bulk of the energy is still in that produced fluid, but we just increase the quality. So we then get a boost on the efficiency of the turbines we use at the surface.
I mean, theoretically, you could store it above ground as well, right? You could just put sand in containers and run pipes through them, couldn't you? I mean, have you seen the device that Henrik Stiesdal is working on?
That particular one, no. But in terms of the basic idea, yes. In fact, we've done some analysis on similar things, like packed bed, gravel is one way, and run your thermal oil through mm-hmm. that. And I think there mm-hmm. that is definitely cheaper relative to batteries or even just using more thermal oil. You definitely can store above ground. The issue really gets into, okay, for seasonal storage, you've got to store a unit of energy and it's got to stay there all year, and you use it 6 months later. And then when you use it, like if you're transferring solar from the summer over to the winter, you use that unit of storage in the summer, and it's unavailable to store more energy. and then you discharge it in the winter, and then it's unavailable to accept more energy because there's not surplus energy in the winter to store. So you're waiting mm-hmm. to charge it until the summer, until there's something, until there's surplus. So you're literally using it once per year. And so even sand in a constructed system is too expensive to do that. If you have the geology that's just there, literally 6 cubic miles is just there, it's free. And the wells to get in and out, really all you can really afford to do is drill the wells. And then you access this ridiculous quantity of thermal capacity. And in our case, for the low-hanging fruit, the wells are also already there. So it's a step function change mm-hmm. in cost.
Is water a limiting factor?
Oh, yes and no. What did Mark Twain say? Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. So that's nowhere more true than in San Joaquin Valley in California. So with that said, they do have water that they use already to make the steam and do this. And that's another part of our unique IP, is that our heat exchangers can work with the kind of water. You can't drink this water with the kind of water they have available to go downhole. And so that's really, yeah. So you got to be able to use the water that's available, that's there. I've got another interesting thing you might find interesting. This is much more nascent, but it's super interesting, that actually triggers when you just asked about the water. So at these power plants, we can't do evaporative cooling. The water resource just isn't there to just do evaporative cooling. So power plants need cooling somehow. So there's, in situations like this, there's products called air-cooled condensers. They're just big fans, okay? So you're blowing a lot of this waste heat into the air. It's on the back end of the power plant after you've extracted usable energy from your heat flow and you just need to cool. So a second observation, and I realize there's people also looking at this and we might work with some of the groups doing this. But if you mm-hmm. think about direct air capture of CO2, you have the technical requirement of high airflow and you have high thermal flow because you have typically use a sorbent, a CO2 sorbent. Once mm-hmm. it's full of CO2, typically they heat it and that drives off the CO2. So you have a thermal flow. And those are the two big costs of doing direct air capture, is that pushing the air and pushing the heat. That's exactly the same technical requirement specification as an air cooling system for a power plant. You're pushing large amounts of air and large amounts of heat. Mm-hmm. So they have these big air handling units. I've reached out and I'm working with some groups that have a CO2 sorbent where the recharge temperature is the same temperature as the temperature range to cool a power plant. And we're just putting this sorbent in line with these air-cooled, air cooling systems. And so there's the opportunity. We don't have this as part of our demo project yet, but mm-hmm. We are in the early stages of looking at this. And I'm saying this because I know that other people are also looking at this. And so I know I'm not crazy. The idea of using air cooling at thermal power plants and just sticking a CO2 sorbent in line and pulling out, doing direct air capture as a byproduct yeah. of your renewable power plant. And in our case, we're excited because if we can get this working, if somebody can get this working, we'll just buy what they've got working. There's multiple people working on this. But if we get this working, what you then have is probably between $20 and $50 a ton carbon. Because again, most the heat's free. In fact, you want to get rid of it. And that's a big part of the cost of direct air capture is recharging the sorbent. And the airflow is also, sort of close to free because you're moving the air anyway to cool your plant. And a large chunk of the equipment is also free because, again, you have to pay for it anyway to cool your plant. So if you really do get to $20 to $50 a ton, somewhere in there, you also happen to be next door in San Joaquin Valley where we're starting out. You happen to be next door to a lot of depleted oil wells, oil formations that yeah. have already been identified as great CO2 sequestration sites. Mm-hmm. So if we can capture it at that price point, there's a place for it to go in massive scale underground. So that's much more nascent, but I'm very excited. So what I'm hoping we demonstrate here is solar with an on-off switch that's negative carbon. That's the goal.
Well,
so I can pause for questions there. I see you're like, what is this? What are you talking about?
No, I mean, I don't understand the chemistry of direct air capture well enough to ask good questions about that. I understand they need heat and electricity and, you know, it's a selective geography where they tend to site their facilities.
Yes.
Like Iceland, for a variety of reasons. You need cheap power, but then you also need specific geological formations. The goal is to convert the CO2 to stone so it can't leak out of the ground again. Well, what else should our listeners know about Hyperlight? And yeah, if anything, if we've exhausted that, that's cool too. I'm happy to bring any more info to the audience.
You know, follow us, check out the website to learn more, and just stay tuned. I'm crossing my fingers and hoping we can keep with some good announcements and some good projects that are exciting. I love talking about this stuff, and I really appreciate you taking the time and giving me the opportunity to talk about this stuff. I'm a fan, love the show, and glad to have been on it.
Well, you can check out all of our content at cleanpower.group/podcast. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel. Just hit the YouTube icon there. Subscribe, hit the bell so you get notifications. And then on the audio side, go to Apple or Spotify, whatever your favorite platform is, and please give us a rating and a review. That's how other people will find this content. And ultimately, that's the goal. This is a numbers game, like so many things in life, and it's game on. We need to attract hundreds of thousands of more people to this core of the clean energy transition. And so that is the mission that we are on, speeding the energy transition. I want to thank John King, the CEO of Hyperlight, for coming on the show today. Thank you so much, John. And look forward to seeing you blossom, and we'll have to bring you back in a couple of years and see, you know, the progress you've made.
Is that a promise?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. I agree. Let's do it.
I love repeat guests. So, and with that, let's grow solar and storage. I'm Tim Montague. Have a great day, everyone. The Clean Power Hour is brought to you by CPS America, the maker of North America's number one three-phase string inverter. With over 6 gigawatts shipped in the U.S., the CPS America product lineup includes three-phase string inverters ranging from 25 to 275 kW. Their flagship inverter, the CPS250-275, is designed to work with solar plants ranging from 2 megawatts to 2 gigawatts. The 250-275 pairs well with CPS America's exceptional data communication, controls, and energy storage solutions. Go to chintpowersystems.com to find out more.